Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Bray, a historian and author who examines the dangerous links between Trump, the Republican Party, and vigilante violence targeting progressive activists at Black Lives Matter protests. Ryan Schleeding of Greenpeace USA, who talks about the campaign to stop the Trump administration's plan to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling for oil and gas. And Amanda Marcotte, senior political writer for Salon.com, who discusses the threat posed by the growing QAnon movement that has attached itself to right-wing causes, Donald Trump, and the Republican Party. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Competing claims to energy resources in the Eastern Mediterranean crossed the line when Greek and Turkish Navy warships collided on August 12th. The Kemal Reis, a Turkish frigate, was one of the five escort ships sent to protect the Oruç Reis, a research vessel hunting for undersea oil and gas. When a Greek Navy ship, the Limnos, approached the research vessel, its bow collided with the rear of the Turkish warship. A Greek defense spokesperson described the collision as an accident, while Ankara called it a provocation. As tensions between Turkey and Greece increased after the collision, European Union foreign ministers called on the two NATO allies to pull back from any future military escalation. The waters off the coasts of Cyprus and Crete, where the Turkish ship was surveying, is an area where both countries claim control. Clashes between Turkey and Greece have ranged from conflicts over boundaries of offshore continental shelves and airspace to the ethnically split island of Cyprus, which Turkey invaded in 1974. The two countries came to the brink of war in 1996 over disputed Aegean islands. The current dispute in the Eastern Mediterranean is focused on energy, security, and ideology. For months, Donald Trump has blamed China for the rapid spread of the coronavirus, labeling COVID-19 the Chinese or Wuhan virus, in an attempt to shift blame for the more than 185,000 Americans who have died during the pandemic. In a cable TV news interview, Peter Navarro, the president's trade advisor, suggested the coronavirus is a deliberate Chinese attack. Trump's anti-China rhetoric is dutifully repeated by Fox News and other right-wing media outlets. According to In These Times magazine, the pro-Trump super PAC, America First, has spent millions of dollars in swing states attacking Joe Biden over his criticism that Trump's January Chinese travel ban was xenophobic, calling the Democratic nominee Beijing Biden. Similar attacks are a feature of Republican Senate campaign ads. Biden and the Democratic establishment initially chose to attack Trump as insufficiently hawkish, fanning anti-China sentiment and contributing to a dangerous rise in hate crimes targeting Asian Americans. Bellicose campaign attacks against China could lead to new Cold War confrontations, especially in the tense waters of the South China Sea. Progressive military analyst Michael Clare observed, "The U.S. military is headed down an extremely dangerous path, and one likely to lead to miscalculation and war." Gray's Ferry, an African-American neighborhood in South Philadelphia, suffers from high rates of asthma and cancer. The community sits adjacent to an aging Philadelphia Energy Solutions refinery, which regularly released toxic chemicals like benzene and hydrogen cyanide that exceed federal health standards. The New York Times Magazine reports that local activists have identified dozens of residents in Gray's Ferry who have cancer, which they believe are linked to the local pollution generated by the PES refinery. In June 2019, the refinery caught fire, which triggered explosions and sent toxic materials into the sky above the poor African-American neighborhood. Local health officials insisted the area was safe from the fire, but 4 months later, a Chemical Safety Investigation Board reported the refinery explosion released 5,000 pounds of highly toxic hydrofluoric acid. Later research revealed that before the explosion, the refinery released the hazardous chemical benzene 21 times above the federal limit during an 18-month span. The company declared bankruptcy, and earlier this year, the property was sold. Black communities like Grays Ferry shoulder a disproportionate burden of the nation's pollution, from foul water in Flint, Michigan, to dangerous chemicals that have poisoned a corridor of Louisiana known as Cancer Alley. A 2017 NAACP report found that African Americans are 75% more likely than other Americans to live in communities located near facilities that produce hazardous waste. Although Black communities suffer disproportionate health effects from environmental pollution, African Americans historically have been left out of decision-making in the U.S. environmental movement. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
During a week of escalating violence at social justice protests, two Black Lives Matter activists were killed, and a third was wounded when Kyle Rittenhouse used his AR-15 rifle to shoot at demonstrators who'd gathered in Kenosha, Wisconsin on August 25th to protest the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Rittenhouse has been charged with 6 criminal counts, including first-degree intentional homicide. 17-year-old Rittenhouse, who's from Illinois, had been with a militia group on the evening of the shooting, which included at least one person who's promoted white supremacist propaganda. In Portland, Oregon, Aaron Danielson was shot and killed on the evening of August 29th after clashes that followed a pro-Trump car caravan that drove into the city's downtown area. Danielson was wearing a hat with the insignia of Patriot Prayer, a far-right group that has clashed with Portland protesters in the past. When asked during a recent press briefing, President Trump declined to condemn Rittenhouse, who's charged with double murder, claiming, without evidence, that it appeared the gunman was acting in self-defense. In reference to Portland, Mr. Trump praised the pro-Trump caravan of activists as great patriots, although their presence appeared to contribute to the violence on the night of Danielson's death. Your reporter spoke with Mark Bray, a historian of human rights, terrorism, and politics, and a lecturer at Rutgers University. Bray, the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, talks about the dangerous links between Trump, the Republican Party, and vigilante violence targeting progressive activists.
Even if we look at the comments he made earlier about how Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old gunman in Kenosha, was simply defending himself, and that he even said that had he not shot those protesters, he would have been killed himself. Earlier on in Trump's administration, people would talk about him dog whistling to the far right. He's no longer, you know, coding what he's doing. He's very clearly talking to and encouraging far right. And of course, the difference between right and far right is increasingly less clear as the Trump administration goes along, but increasingly encouraging far right violence. Regarding the Trump caravan in Portland, where his supporters were on the back of pickup trucks shooting paintball guns at protesters, you know, he said apparently something to the effect that, well, it's just paint, it's not real bullets. Meanwhile, he called for protesters who threw paint at statues to get 10 years in prison. So it's a very alarming situation, both in terms of how the far right is becoming increasingly more emboldened to be violent in response to the Black Lives Matter protests. Frankly, I'm somewhat surprised it took this long, because when the massive protests after the police killing of George Floyd erupted, I expected this to come more quickly. I'm pleased that it took a while, but of course it's unfortunate that it has emerged. It reflects the kind of substantive, deep-seated divisions, given the history of white supremacy and racism in this country, that have erupted. And Trump is losing in the polls. He's trying to present himself as a law and order candidate. Anyone who watched some of the RNC can see how the Republicans are trying to paint the election in very stark terms, that basically Biden and the Democrats are somehow encouraging violence, encouraging property destruction, and that if they win as one of the speakers said, we'll have a socialist utopia in the United States, which anyone who's been following Democratic politics will know is far from the truth. But yeah, he's trying to present himself as a law and order candidate, and it helps him to have disorder now in, as he calls it, Democratic cities in order to get there.
Mark, you specifically called out the Republican conventions featuring Mark and Patricia McCloskey, who were well publicized as brandishing their firearms during a peaceful Black Lives Matter protest in their hometown of St. Louis, Missouri. And there was plenty of video footage of them in the front yard of their home brandishing, I believe, a handgun and what looked like a semi-automatic weapon. Again, it was a peaceful social justice protest that had just gone by their house, but yet they were there brandishing these weapons, and they were celebrated by the Republican convention. What's the link in your mind between the message sent out with their appearance at this convention and the militia activity that we've seen step up in recent days?
Right. You don't need an advanced degree in politics to see the connection, right? Especially if you watch the speech that the McCloskeys gave about how they believed that they were being threatened, that their lives and property were in danger, and that these kinds of, as they phrase the kind of violent, threatening protests are coming to what they called quiet neighborhoods all across the country, which of course is coded language for white suburbs. And similarly, there have been this wave of Antifa bus hoaxes where the far right creates fake anti-fascist social media profiles that threaten to bring busloads of violent anti-fascists into predominantly white suburban areas and commit property destruction in order to alarm local residents and get their sympathies for a kind of more vigilante form of justice. So, you know, these kinds of fears are connected that quiet neighborhoods are under attack, traditional values are under attack in American society, the America that you grew up with, as they phrase it, is being threatened, and trying to tie into the kind of history of American individualism and gun rights and kind of frontier justice, the argument is, hey, if the police can't stop this from happening, then you gun owners have not only the right but the obligation to do so. And, you know, with militias, that's just a more organized form of that very same impulse. And it reflects a long history of armed white violence against Black freedom struggles.
That was Mark Bray, a historian of human rights, terrorism, and politics, and a lecturer at Rutgers University. Bray is the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Find more perspectives on the rise in violence at social justice protests across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After a 30-year battle, Congress voted to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, to oil and gas drilling in 2017, when both houses were controlled by Republicans. That was what Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski demanded in exchange for her vote in favor of President Trump's massive tax cut bill. Trump recently instructed administration officials to move forward on opening leases on the 19.6 million acre refuge, which is more than three times the size of the Adirondacks in New York, or one third the size of Wyoming. Trump Interior Secretary David Bernhardt, a former oil and gas lobbyist, announced on August 17th that by the end of this year, fossil fuel drilling leases will start being sold on a 1.56 million acre area of the Alaskan Refuge's pristine coastal plain. The move has been strongly opposed by the Gwich'in indigenous people, who depend on the caribou whose calving grounds are in ANWR, by environmentalists, and by people who oppose building fossil fuel infrastructure in what many consider a sacred place. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ryan Schleeding, senior communications specialist with Greenpeace USA, one of the group's leading opposition to drilling in the Arctic. Here he talks about what's at stake and what difference a Biden presidency could make in stopping fossil fuel exploitation in ANWR.
What is new here, anyway, is that Trump has instructed his Department of Interior to put a couple of vast areas within the Arctic Refuge up for sale, for lease for oil and gas companies. And as far as oil development in the area, there has been some seismic testing that has begun around the Arctic Refuge. Seismic testing is the first step towards looking to see where oil might be underground or underwater. And it also has its own set of damages to wildlife. It's a question mark as to how much oil and gas is underneath the soil there, but really the sort of main point for us is that it all needs to stay underground for a variety of climate, environmental, and sort of justice-related reasons.
With oil prices already low and then getting really pummeled by the pandemic, some experts are predicting not a lot of companies will even bid on these leases.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because when this was first put to the current Congress in 2017, the oil industry and the oil market looked a lot different. So Chevron and BP, for example, were two of the biggest companies that had, within the last few years, expressed interest in drilling in the Arctic Refuge. And those companies are in very different places now than when they expressed that interest. So BP announced plans earlier this year that it was going to reduce oil and gas production by 40% by 2030. So it's really hard to see them meeting that goal while expanding into the Alaskan Arctic. And Chevron had to write down its assets earlier this year and lost billions of dollars and announced that it was going to have to make some sort of contractions in where it was looking to expand and explore new business. So that also makes exploration in the Alaskan Arctic for Chevron a lot less likely. Smaller and mid-sized oil companies have been hit even harder by the market downturn. So it's really hard to imagine any oil company actually bidding on these lease sales right now and trying to explore, given how contentious this location is, the potential delays. It wouldn't be the first time that Trump's climate or environmental policy or economic policy sort of flew in the face of what reality and the market and the science was saying. But it's definitely not a guarantee that any oil companies would even bid on this or pursue it.
So, Ryan Schlieder, do you think maybe throwing so much energy into stopping this is misdirected and environmentalists should be focusing on other crises?
Well, we definitely need to treat it seriously because it's not just the prospect of drilling in the Arctic Refuge. It's the idea that if oil companies can unlock this place that's been protected for so many decades and that holds such cultural significance, really no protected area is off limits. So this is a precedent that we cannot allow to be set.
What's the timeline anyway?
The earliest auctions would not be until after the election, this could also be a part of an electoral strategy to signify to fossil fuel industry donors that have supported Trump that he is willing to sort of go as far as trying to open up the Arctic Refuge, which is a battle that they've been waging, as you mentioned, for decades now. But it wouldn't be until later this year after the election.
It was Congress that had to vote on opening or not opening ANWR to drilling. Biden has said that he's opposed to drilling there. What impact could his election have on this?
The Department of the Interior would sort of oversee the lease sales. And even if Congress weren't to reverse the sort of budgetary decision that made lease sales possible in the Arctic Refuge, a Biden cabinet and administration could just not hold lease sales, essentially, is one way this could work out. Another way it could work out is that Congress could reverse that law and make drilling off limits. There's a number of routes. We expect to see legal challenges, like even within the next couple of months, to the Trump administration decision.
Please comment on the climate impacts of opening ANWR to drilling.
From a climate perspective, it's never made sense to drill in the Arctic Refuge. So a study that came out in 2015, even, so 5 years ago, said that if we're going to limit global warming to the agreed upon goals in the Paris Agreement, 100% of Arctic oil and gas needs to stay in the ground. And then in the last 6 months, from an economic perspective, it's starting to make even less sense. So this decision really isn't motivated by anything related to science or economics. This is very much a statement to Trump's donor base and to his friends in the fossil fuel industry that regardless of what reality suggests, he's going to continue to work for them and against the interests of people across the country, including in Alaska.
That was Ryan Schlieding, Senior Communications Specialist with Greenpeace USA. Learn more about the campaign to stop drilling for oil and gas in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. QAnon, a growing national movement that promotes a bizarre conspiracy theory that believes Donald Trump is engaged in a covert war with a global cabal of powerful Satan-worshipping elites who control the world and run a child sex ring, has recently crossed over from the fringe to right-wing and Republican politics. In early August, QAnon supporter Marjorie Taylor Greene won a Republican primary, where she's now nearly certain to win a House seat in the November election. President Trump has embraced Greene as a future Republican star. The group, which has a major presence on social media, promotes false information about the coronavirus pandemic, the Black Lives Matter protests, and the 2020 election. QAnon supporters have worked to infiltrate other conservative activist groups, such as the anti-vaccine and anti-child trafficking movements. There have been several criminal incidents involving QAnon followers, including one member who was accused of murdering a mafia boss last year, and another who was arrested for allegedly threatening to kill former vice president and current presidential candidate Joe Biden. The FBI has since warned that QAnon poses a potential domestic terror threat. Your reporter spoke with Amanda Marcotte, senior political writer for Salon.com, who discusses her recent article titled, "Is QAnon the New Christian Right?"
So QAnon is this conspiracy theory that really formulated online in the days after Trump's election. It started on 4chan when a user claiming to be a high-level official in the Trump administration started making pretty ridiculous claims that a lot of Trump's more bizarre behavior was not what it seems, that in fact it's part of his elaborate plan to take down what Q said was a worldwide pedophilia conspiracy. He's accused most Democratic officials and politicians of being involved in this pedophilia conspiracy. He's accused Oprah Winfrey and Tom Hanks of being in it. And he says that Trump has a secret plan to take all these pedophiles down. He also accuses them of being Satan worshipers and cannibals. Unfortunately, as ridiculous as that sounds, huge numbers of people, I would say probably we're looking at millions at this point, have some investment or are entirely sold on the QAnon conspiracy theory. Their Facebook pages are wildly popular. Their Twitter accounts were wildly popular until Twitter purged a bunch of them. At Trump rallies, QAnon merch sells just as well, if not better than Trump merch. And, you know, it is a ridiculous conspiracy theory, but you see these kinds of ridiculous conspiracy theories crop up over and over again in history to justify, well, frankly, fascism. You know, it's very reminiscent of in Nazi Germany how the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a document accusing Jewish people of being involved in a similar conspiracy, was very popular and was used to justify the Holocaust.
Now, you speak about the self-righteousness of adherence to this conspiracy theory, to QAnon, which makes them particularly dangerous. They say they're protecting sexually abused children, so when they go up against their quote-unquote enemies, their belief is they're protecting defenseless children. So some of these people believe any length that they go to is justified, whether it be violence or something else, in the interest of protecting these children.
Yeah, and it's clearly a psychological rationalization, because people that adhere to QAnon have no evidence outside of their belief in this conspiracy theory about caring about sex trafficking, caring about children's welfare, caring about anything of that nature. It really is sort of a way to rationalize a pre-existing desire to believe that violence against Democrats and violent suppression of the opposition is okay, and to justify it by saying it's about stopping violence against children. It reminds me quite a bit of the anti-abortion movement, which has been playing the same game for years, claiming that they oppose abortion rights because of life and the babies and all that, but when you actually look at their records outside of protesting abortion clinics, trying to take away women's rights, doing violence against abortion providers, and you look to, have they ever invested in health care for children? Have they ever done anything to help women go forward with their pregnancies if they want to? The answer is no. They don't actually care about children.
Now, Amanda, we didn't touch on some of the parts of the article where you discuss the fading evangelical right movement and its long-standing relationship with the Republican Party, and your thoughts that this new cult in QAnon could be something that's going to crop up to replace the evangelicals in the GOP.
The reality is QAnon functions the same way the evangelical movement did. For many decades, basically my entire life, the evangelical right has existed to put a moral gloss on immoral policies, right? They have defended racist policies, sexist policies, supply-side economics, aggressive, unnecessary overseas wars. The Republicans have done all these things, and they've gotten away with it because they have all these ministers who are running around saying, we're the moral ones because of X, Y, and Z, but mostly because they are sex scolds and prudes, right? That kind of worked, but I think in the past 5 or 6 years, I think what's happened is the American appetite for being the sex police has really kind of diminished, and people just don't care as much anymore. So now you have QAnon kind of stepping forward with a different way to say, you're the good guy if you're a Republican because now it's just a completely ridiculous conspiracy theory. But the whole point of it is the Republican Party has pretty consistently backed immoral policies for decades, and they're getting worse under Donald Trump. And as they get worse, they need more and more excuses for why they're not bad people. And QAnon is kind of stepping in to fill that role.
That was Amanda Marcotte, senior politics writer with Salon.com and author of the book Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters. Find more analysis and commentary on the QAnon movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Progressive Voices Network, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.